to episode 365 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Seth
and Jessica Carr.
And in today's episode, we'll be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we'll be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with 1954's Godzilla, the OG. And we're going to talk, a little bit. This is the Japanese, specific, like the fully Japanese one. We'll talk a little bit about how there is an American version. I'm sure most people are familiar with Godzilla, King of the Monsters, which came out in the 50s in America because we're stupid. Couldn't just watch the Japanese version. So we're watching the OG version.
I didn't know that existed, actually.
I just spoiled.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Perry Mason is in it.
We got some stuff on the website if you have not had checked it out recently. I mentioned that some new reviews, but we also have a new review of F9, the new Fast and Furious movie from Logan Kinney on cinematary.com that just came out on Monday. So check that out if you would like to... read a little bit about the Fast and Furious movies, which just got a release date for the 10th movie. So, it's not going to ever end. It's never going to end. It's great. Let's go ahead and jump into movies that we saw this week. And I'm going to kick us off with it came out late last year, correct, Jessica? Yeah, a late last year movie, Shiva Baby, which is the feature directorial. She's directed other things, but this is the feature directorial debut of Emma Sligman.
Wow.
And...
yeah, I think so.
It's never going to end.
Really, it's like, do you want to watch a comedy, but it's shot like a horror movie? Shiva Baby is the right one for you. The plot is you have this college student, played by Rachel Sennott, and she you meet her when she's having sex with her sugar daddy, and she leaves his apartment to go to a Shiva with her family. And when she gets there, she not only sees that her ex-girlfriend, who's played by Molly Gordon, is there, but also the sugar daddy and his wife and child are there. And so the like remaining 70 or so minutes of this movie is just like pure awkwardness and anxiety. And because you have just like that whole plot set up, and then you just have like kind of Jewish family dynamics of like relatives and family members coming up asking her like what she's doing with her life. And if she's like gonna graduate soon, and does she have any job prospects, and like is she seeing anybody? And you just like have that like littered in there with her trying to navigate all these other awkwardness between her girlfriend and her sugar daddy. I really liked it. It's on HBO Max at the moment. I like that it's like it's absolutely shot like it was, you know. Like, honestly, they could have marketed this thing like an A24 horror movie because it feels like that. Like, you kind of have, like, this almost Mika Levy type, like, string score to it. And it has a lot of these, like, kind of medium shots where, like, the action's happening in the background. You're listening to, like, them talk about her as if she's not here. And she has, like, a lot of these scenes where she's, like... And I really related to this because I've done this a lot at like parties and functions where like she'll be listening to them talking about something, and it's not even necessarily related to her, but she'll be listening to them talk about something that's like just related to life in general. And she like is like picking up food and just like stacking food, and she's not even eating the food. Like a lot of the time there's once and she'll just like take off the food. I really related to that. That really, like, you know, I was like, I've done that before where I've just, like, picked up food because I awkwardly did not want to talk to anybody, like, who was, like, around the whole food plate situation. But I really like this. I think it was just directed in a way that I think it really captures anxiety in a way. Not too far off from something like Uncut Gems where, that one is just, like, kind of... just this intense anxiety kind of thrown at you, and it's really It's really like claustrophobic and just like constant. This one is like that, but it kind of has this claustrophobia of like you're just locked into this small function. You kind of, you don't really get a sense of like the architecture of this house, but you just know there's a lot of different rooms with a lot of different people in it and a lot of like setups of like chairs and food and like just things in the way. And you just never feel very comfortable in it. And I think the main actress, Rachel Sennett, she really like captures not only just this kind of like millennial Gen Z college student who's just kind of trying to be like irreverent to, you know, just the need by her family members to like answer these like incessant questions, but also she just understand like the way that she kind of captures the levity of like the anxiety and the awkwardness of this entire situation. I think she does that so well. Jessica, I know you've seen this as well. What did you make of Shiva Baby?
Yeah, it's super good. I was honestly like very surprised whenever I watched it. I saw lots of people logging it on Letterboxd whenever it went to VOD, and I was like, I need to check this out. I love the poster of it. It looks so good. It's very creative. But yeah, I saw that she started out with a short film. I think it's of the same name and with the same actress.
It's a similar conceit.
Yeah, yeah. And so I thought that it was like very cool that she was able to take this concept and make it into a full-length movie, a full-length feature, because you would think, oh, this is the perfect plot for a short specifically, but to be able to extend that like feeling of anxiety and to build and build and build the tension over the course of like an 80-minute like feature is insane to me. Like, I can't even think of like how she was able to just keep you in there and to keep throwing in things that were like, okay, so her ex-girlfriend's here and they are having a flirty moment with each other in the corner, and her mom sees, and her mom like is kind of grappling with the fact that her daughter like could be gay, and she's like pulling her away from them being together, but then at the same time, from across the room, her sugar daddy is also seeing her talk to her ex-girlfriend, and it's just like this labyrinth of using space and people to just create anxiety in a way that's also very funny, because you're the audience member is like, oh shit, how could this get any more tense? And you think that it can't, and then it does. And then the wife walks in with the baby, and you're like, okay, great. And it just, like, completely escalates. And at the same time, I feel like you have a lot of empathy for the character, even though, you know, technically she made this bed that she now has to sleep in. Like, she lied to her family, she lied to all these people, and she has this kind of, like, self-destructive personality, but you still feel for her because it's, like, not a comfortable situation for anybody, and she's, like, a pretty relatable character. And so it sets it up for it to just be this, like, beautiful symphony of anxiety and the feeling that you have after you graduate from college, where you're like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, and now I have to appear in front of all these adults and look like I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And no,
I think you're right though. Like she does a good job of like building, you know, build, cause it could just kind of end at like, you have the sugar daddy there and you have the ex-girlfriend there and that's awkward enough, but she's able to like kind of keep build like and she builds on it and it feels like natural. Like it keeps escalating. Like at one point, you know, she sends like a promiscuous text to the sugar daddy. Then she's like making out with her ex-girlfriend outside. Then like it's just like it just keeps up in the end. You're just like, where? And then like I won't spoil the way it ends, but like the way it ends, you're like, you honestly probably could have gone, like, it's impressive that this is only 80 minutes, because like the way it ends, you probably could have like milked another 15 minutes out of that movie. And it kind of leaves you with just like this, not necessarily, like, you don't really get this sense of relief. You just, like, almost get, like, this exhale of just, like, oh, my God. Like, it just, you just leave with, like, this, you know, it's not necessarily over, but it's, like, over for you. Like, you've got off the exit. But Shiva Baby, it's on HBO, and then it's on any of the on-demand streaming platforms if you'd like to rent it. So I recommend it. I think even though we used the word anxiety 50 times in that review, and I kind of honestly I was kind of reticent to like watch it because that's what I was described as, like, it's just a very anxious time, and I'm like, well, I mean, I can deal with that on a daily basis. I don't need like to watch a movie to experience that. I was very entertained by it. I thought it was very funny. And like I said, I think the craft of it kind of goes, it's a little underrated, just like how well made the movie is. because I think you have to put a lot of skill into engaging with the audience on all of these different subject matters, as well as like the way, like I said, the way it's structured, it feels like a horror movie. So like it's not like a studio comedy where there's like, you're gonna have like needle drops for different pop songs. It's like, no, it's like the string music that stresses you out more than the situation. But speaking of awkward, stressful situations, Jessica, you dipped your toe into the Twin Peaks pool recently.
Yeah, so here is my backstory about this. So I love David Lynch. Whenever I was like, you know, dipping my toes in cinema, like obviously people bring up David Lynch, and like I love his movies. I try to watch all of them. But there was one, like, thing that was just, like, I didn't want to touch, and that was Twin Peaks, like, the TV show, because every film dude that I had ever talked to in college was like, Twin Peaks is the best show in the whole world, and nothing can compare to it. And I immediately was like, well, I'm not gonna watch it. I'm like, David Lynch is a movie guy. He's my movie guy. So I'm not gonna watch his TV show. And also, why do people keep talking about this lady with a log? And also, I don't understand what you're talking about, and I don't get it, so I'm just not gonna do it. So leave me alone. And so I was like, okay, I'm not gonna watch it. Well, and then the return happened, which made it even more obnoxious because people on this podcast wouldn't stop talking about it. And so it.
And you know who you are.
And so it furthered my, yeah, I'm not gonna do it because you told me to do it, so I'm not going to. And then there was.
I had the same experience. Yeah. Oh, man. That is exactly me.
And then there was a pandemic. There's still a pandemic, but we were quarantined last year. I had a lot of free time on my hands, and I thought, you know what? I'm gonna watch Twin Peaks. You know what? I'm just gonna watch it, and I'm just gonna see what the whole hubbub is about. And I watched through the first season, and then I started having really bad nightmares because it is terrifying. Like, it is so scary. And I started having, I mean, obviously it was also a bad time mentally for everybody, but I started having just like nightmares that people were trying to come through the wall and like strangle me like while I was sleeping. So I had to take a little pause.
Are you saying, so like, did any of those fuckers come out of the wall and like just jizz?
Oh my gosh, no. No. Oh, I think
he did it. He snuck it in.
Anyways, he did it. He snuck it in. We knew that he would. But yeah, so I finally got to the second season, and I got to the point in the show where the killer is revealed, Laura Palmer's killer is revealed, and at that point, everybody was like, okay, you have to watch Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me. This is the point in the second season where...
Isn't that like set before the show, though?
Well, it's Laura Palmer's life before she's killed. So it's like her last couple of days alive. So it matches up with, like, you find out who... You have to know who the killer is before you watch Fire Walk With Me. So you have to get to that point in the show. According to all these experts that I was listening to, you have to...
I didn't do that. I did not do that.
Oh, no. So did it make sense to you? When did you watch the movie?
But that's the thing. I had seen all the David Lynch movies up to that point and had not seen Twin Peaks. And I was like... People are like, well, how did it make sense to you? And I'm like, making sense, you know? Like,
What are you talking about? No David Lynch movie really makes a whole bunch of sense. I wouldn't really, like...
In his own
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I wouldn't really explain it like that. But then you start having galaxy brain stuff where you're like, oh, and then this blue rose showed up, and it was the ring that, like, transported them into the red room and whatever.
No, for sure.
Yeah, it's like...
No, there's real stuff, especially with the show.
Oh,
yeah.
All just stuff connecting and whatever. But so I finally... And I was very nervous to watch the movie, but Central Cinema in Knoxville was showing it, because they had, like, a employee pick type of thing, and one of their employees was like, oh, Fire Walk With Me, it's the best. And I finally watched it, and I watched it in a theater, and I was, like, very nervous to revisit it because I had taken a pause with it. And it is not a fun time. Like, Fire Walk With Me is easily, like, David Lynch's most disturbing, most horrifying and painful movie, and it is that way because of the sexual trauma that is portrayed in it and just how horrendous it is in the murder of Laura Palmer and the way that it happens. And it's just, like, it's very, very sad to watch. And I don't know, like, it's not a good time, not good feelings, but it is, like, so expertly done, like, crafted so well, and he puts, like, so much care into it that it is almost impossible for you not to watch it and think, like, this is an amazing film. And I know that I was like, oh, I'm not gonna watch Twin Peaks. But, like, I think that Fire Walk With Me is, like, better than the show in its entirety. Like, I think the movie as, like, a piece itself is just, like, it's so good. I don't know. The performances are amazing. The way that everything looks, the different, like, there's a scene in the movie where the Laura Palmer gets this painting, and it's just of, like, floral wallpaper and then a door that's, like, just slightly open, and she hangs it up on her wall and then has these, like, nightmares, and she wakes up and she looks over at the painting, and then she turns, and then it cuts to her in the doorway. So she's inside the painting now, and then she starts to follow, the camera, like, follows inside the walls of the painting, and
so awesome.
It's like, there's an old woman there that's, like, pointing and telling her where to go, and it's just like, the thing to me that makes David Lynch movies so terrifying is that it captures the feeling of what a nightmare is like. So there are, things look normal except for one thing, and, like, a person is talking slower, at a slower rate than they normally do, or something is slightly off and it makes you anxious and you don't know why and you can't really put your finger on it. But it is what a nightmare feels like. It's like you don't know the way that things are going, and you're confused, and you don't know why, and you kind of just wake up sweating. And that is exactly how his movies make you feel. And, oh my gosh. It's like, I don't know. How much
Kung Fu Panda did you watch after this movie?
I actually went home and watched over the last episode of Over the Garden Wall. So
you had to to purge it out a little bit.
Yeah, I was like, let me watch a cartoon about death. That will help me feel better. Cool.
Well, nice isn't melancholic it, cartoon.
Isn't David Bowie in that? In Fire Walk With
he
Me?
He's in like a scene with Gordon and Cooper.
Man.
But like,
see, that's also like my dream.
Yeah. And he I didn't watch the missing pieces, which is the parts that were cut out of Fire Walk With Me. I don't plan on watching it. I liked thinking of the movie as a whole, just as it is already. But like, if you want to watch, I think somebody edited the missing pieces into Fire Walk With Me, and it's like 4 hours long, and I'm not trying to do that. So if you're interested in doing that, cool. I know that there are people who are like super fans of it, and they're, oh man, but I don't know. I appreciate it as a piece of art, and I think the thing to me that is so fascinating about David Lynch is that he can see the undertones of just things that are corrupted or disturbed in just like suburbia, where it's like there's something nasty under the surface, and it is like people who are abused or facing trauma and how they have to like cope with that. And I think that he just like cares so much about telling that those stories, like he puts so much care into it that it's just, I mean, he's doing the dang thing. I don't know.
are you guys ready for this transition?
Yeah.
Well, Fire Walk With Me, it's available, I believe. I think it's on Criterion now, so you can watch it through there. But you know, that movie is about Laura Palmer, who's a victim. Speaking of victim, Seth, you just watched the movie Victim.
From 1961, Basil Dearden. It's a British. That was good. That was a really good bridge. Man, we were rehearsing that before we went live. No, we weren't. We were. Yeah, we'll just say we were. Victim. It's set in London. It's got this like almost TV drama. It feels like it's gonna be just like a, like, I don't know, like some kind of like police procedural or something. But it's actually one of the first, like, for my money, like gay thrillers. It's like about these the circle of gay Londoners that are being blackmailed by a mysterious guy on a motorcycle and his mom. And I'm pretty sure the guy on the motorcycle is gay too, and he just hates himself or something. But that's just me reading into the movie and getting ahead of myself. But it's interesting. It's a lot of the time it's definitely an ensemble, and it goes from like the perspective of like the gay men in London that are being blackmailed, and the police that are investigating this and working with some of the men who are like trying to be like cagey about the whole thing and secretive about the whole thing, because one of their number, like because of the blackmail, wound up committing suicide, and this really sets the whole thing into motion, and the investigation and everything. And it's just really interesting because of both what it like is ahead of its time for and gets right, and also interesting for what it like gets wrong, because it expresses a lot of sort of the schizoid like ideas. Like, I don't think, from what I've looked at, Basil Dearden is not gay himself, but clearly has like sympathies and is not coming at this from some sort of like staunch Republican like perspective or something. But there's definitely, you know, there's definitely some like emphasis on the police that are trying to, like, get to the bottom of this, and the police can't have judgment on this, and they, like, one way or the other, conveniently, often, and are sort of, like, sometimes our sympathies lie with them too much, being, like, sort of this, like, isn't it strange what men do together or something? But then at the same time, I think it's like...
It's also like the tagline of the movie.
Right, right. Isn't it strange? Because it does have like a tabloid kind of feel. Like, have you ever heard of this? Gay men? Have you ever heard of this?
That would be an amazing tagline.
Yeah. And it has that sort of like sensationalist kind of thing about it. But at the same time, for 1961, it's like the earliest movie I can think of where there's like... They say that... there's like characters talking about how it is like natural to be gay and talking about love, not just like, you know, the sensationalism of like, you know, the political, like two men together. They're talking about how it is, it's love and it's takes many forms and things like that. So it was an interesting film, definitely. I need to find more gay thrillers, I gotta say.
More gay thrillers, where the tagline is, can you believe it? Gay men!
Can you believe it? Who knew?
Where did you watch it? Was it streaming?
It's on Criterion, along with Sapphire, which is another one of this like streak of... That one like tackles race, sort of like with the same... like. Muddled returns, but it is again interesting from the time period perspective and things. But yeah, it's on Criterion.
Nice. All right, Jessica, you're going to take us home with your antidote to Twin Peaks.
As I mentioned previously, I saw Over the Garden Wall, which I had heard described as a creepy cartoon. That was pretty much what everyone was telling me about it. And I was like, well, just how creepy is this here cartoon? And it was released in a series of 10 episodes on Cartoon Network, I'm pretty sure, in 2014. But yeah, it is. And people have been telling me to watch it for a really long time. I just happened to find it on Hulu. And it was there in its entirety, so I was like, I'm gonna watch this. And it stars two brothers, and their story begins just in the middle of them being lost, and we don't know where they came from or why. One of them is dressed up as a garden gnome, and the other one has a teapot on his head.
And a rock. And he's giving rock facts.
Yes. And we don't know. And it's Wirt and Gregory. And Wirt is actually voiced by Elijah Wood. And Elijah Wood did a Hot Ones episode recently. And he talked about how he loved it when people came up to him and talked to him about Over the Garden Wall, because it's one of his favorite projects that he ever did. So that was really neat.
Yeah, luckily he's not done anything else, so that's, you know, that's the go-to.
Well, I think that's what he was talking about. Like, the guy was like, oh, Bayou, what do you like people mentioning? Like, what projects are you most proud of besides, you know, Lord of the Rings or whatever? And he was like, oh, yeah. But, yeah, so they are just in this place called The Unknown, wandering around, and they're trying to get home. And that is the entire thing. And so you figure out, you know, you kind of get a little idea of what the heck the unknown is, and if are they going to make it home. And they run into some weird people where you're like, okay, things are like very strange in this place called the unknown, where there are like animals like dressed as children, and there are like pumpkin head people and all kinds of crazy stuff. But it's like super fun. It has kind of the same energy as like Adventure Time to me. There's lots of like silly characters, but there's also things that are like kind of creepy, and you think, oh, is this too creepy for a kid's show? And there are definitely parts of it where I would say, yeah, I think you would want an older child to maybe watch this, because
it's
a little spooky.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's like it like I think one of the biggest charms of it is that it feels like a much more like traditional like folktale. Like it's like I think that we kind of get that we get lost in that
you know, Brothers Grimm.
Yeah, like Brothers Grimm and things like that. You know, the Snow Queen and like those were like super dark, creepy, demented stories at times. Like the actual story of like Little Mermaid and Cinderella and stuff. Like it's not as cookie cutter and like clean as like Disney movies. And so that's the kind of thing that I like about Over the Garden Wall is that it feels very much like in line with like a more traditional like genuine folktale, because it's not only is it creepy and like engaging with like these kind of like darker themes for children, but it's also like engaging with them in a way that's like investigating you know, broader, much more like human themes. Like you mentioned Adventure Time, I think it's very much in line with that, but I also feel a lot of kinship to Kentucky Route Zero, the video game. It's dealing with like a lot of like kind of uncertainties and kind of trying to fill in blanks that you're not really clear of where that came from or why you need to fill in that blank. I think that it kind of engages with that as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I didn't actually think about that. But yeah, I like it a lot. The characters have arcs, and by the end of it, you feel like they've grown as people, and it's super sweet. And you have fun little songs like Potatoes and Molasses.
Dude, great song.
Beautiful song.
Great songs and great score. God.
Yeah.
Is it how the episodes, are they 20 minutes? Because it's 10 and it's like 20 minute episodes.
Yeah.
It's 10. It's the best thing to watch in fall. It's like just bathed in the aesthetics of fall.
Yeah.
Harvest time. It's perfect time to watch it.
No, I watched this for the first time a couple months ago because it's in that kind of realm of like recent animation. I think that Adventure Time's in there, Steven Universe is in there. What's the other? Gravity Falls, where it's like I'm very jealous of kids today. They have a lot of good animated shows that they get to watch. And I think that like I'm like just kind of echoing what I said before, like Over the Garden Wall really does like engage in like these very traditional folktale tradition, you know, like just like the path that it kind of takes. And I think that you know, some could label that as kind of boring, because I mean it's not reinventing the wheel in any way. Like honestly, it's more of like a slap to most other stories, because it's just kind of following like we mentioned, like Brothers Grimm and other traditional routes. But there's also something very like comforting and nostalgic and you know, just all around appealing about that, you know, like it's good to see that, and good to see like a story like investigated in that way, but also like investigate themes like you're talking about that are not, it doesn't feel dated in that way. Like you really do feel for these characters.
Yeah, I honestly had no idea what was going to happen at the end. Like I really didn't know, and it's been a long time since I've watched something animated where that was the case, so
Yeah, and you mentioned Elijah Wood. He does a really great job like voice acting in this. Melanie Lynskey does a very good job as well. You have Christopher Lloyd. If you're a fan of like of animation, or you're a fan of like folktales and folklore and fantasy, like yeah, I would definitely check this out. It's on, like Jessica mentioned, it's on Hulu. I watched it on HBO Max. They have the entire series on that. And then we'll stop there before I like break into Adventure Time talk, because you know, between that and I Think You Should Leave, like those are just, you know, that's what I'm going for. All right, we're gonna take a quick break and then we will be back talking 1954's Godzilla after this.
Hey, Cemetery listeners, Andrew here. At the midpoint of this week's episode, I want to direct you to some of the non-podcasty things we have to offer. First, if you're a fan of what we do, please consider supporting us on Patreon. For $5 a month, you get three things: a shout out at the end of every episode, the opportunity to choose a movie we cover on the show, and our Patreon exclusive podcast, Film Theory and Chill, in which we look at a piece of theory once a month, deconstruct it, and then just chill out, talking about whatever else we have going on. All Patreon support goes solely to paying our writers for their reviews that go up on our website every Monday. Also, at the bottom of cemetery.com, you can sign up for our free newsletter. Every Sunday, we send out an email with the latest podcast episode, Patreon content, and written reviews. This is perfect for those who want to keep tabs on what's happening, but might be too busy to see the posts when they go up. Before I go, one more quick thing. The easiest thing you can do to support us is to give Cemetery a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the show. This is quick, free, easy, and we will read your review out on the show once we get it. To recap, consider donating to our Patreon, sign up for the free newsletter, and please give us a rating and review. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
Of Cemetery. In this part, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with 1954's Godzilla, directed by Ishiro Honda, from a script by Honda and Takeo Murata. The film stars Akira Takarada, Momoko Kochi Hirata, and Takashi Shimura, who is my favorite. Love me some Takashi Shimura. A fire-breathing behemoth terrorizes Japan after an atomic bomb awakens it from a century... from its centuries-old sleep. You know, that, well, it's just that typical story of, like, there's a behemoth, and he has an atomic bomb, and it wakes him up, and blah, you know, it always happens. In 1954, Toho originally planned to produce Ikko no Kaji ni, which translates to In the Shadow of Glory, which is a Japanese-Indonesian co-production about the aftermath of the Japanese occupation of Indonesia. However, anti-Japanese sentiment in Indonesia forced political pressure on the government to deny visas for the filmmakers. Producers Tomoyuki Tanaka flew to Jakarta to renegotiate with the Indonesian government, but was unsuccessful, and on the flight back to Japan, conceived the idea for a giant monster film inspired by the 1953 film The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and the 20,000 Fathoms and the Daigo Fukuri Fukuru Maru incident that happened in March 1954. The film's opening sequence is a direct reference to the incident, which happened in the 50s, where a Japanese tuna fishing boat was, with a crew of 23 men, was contaminated by nuclear fallout from the United States weapon testing. So that just tells you that things have not changed with the U.S. government. Tanaka felt the film had potential due to nuclear fears, generating news and monster films becoming popular due to the financial success of The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and the 1952 re-release of King Kong, the latter of which earned more money than previous releases. During his flight, Tanaka wrote an outline with the working title The Giant Monster from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and executive producer Iwo Mori approved the project in April 1954 after special effects director Eiji Tsuburaya agreed to do the film's effects. Tsuburaya originally opted for a giant octopus before the filmmakers decided on a dinosaur-inspired creature. Godzilla pioneered a form of special effects called suitmation, in which a stunt performer wearing a suit interacts with miniature sets. Principal photography lasted 51 days, and the special effects photography lasted 71 days. Godzilla was designed by Teizu Toshimitsu and Akira Watanabe under Tsuburaya's supervision. Early on, Tanaka contemplated having the monster be gorilla-like or whale-like in design due to the name Gojira, which is a combination of the Japanese words for gorilla and whale. But eventually, it's a gorilla whale. but eventually settled on a dinosaur-like design. They decided to base his design on dinosaurs, and by using dinosaur books and magazines as a reference, combine elements of a Tyrannosaurus, Iguanodon, and the dorsal fins of a Stegosaurus. The Godzilla suit was constructed by Kanji Yagi, Koi Yagi, and Izo Kaimai, who used thin bamboo sticks and wire to build a frame for the interior of the suit and added metal mesh cushioning over it to bolster its structure, and finally applied coats of latex. Coats of molten rubber were additionally applied, followed by carved indentions and strips of latex glued onto the surface of the suit to create his scaly hide. The first version of the suit weighed 220 pounds, and for close-ups, they created a smaller-scale, mechanical, hand-operated puppet that sprayed steams of mist from its mouth to act as his atomic breath. Haru Nakajima and Katsumi Sezuka were chosen to perform in the suit due to their strength and endurance. At the first costume fitting, Nakajima fell down while inside the suit due to the heavy latex and inflexible material used to create it. This first version of the suit was cut in half and used for scenes requiring only partial shots of Godzilla or close-ups, with the lower half fitted with rope suspenders for Nakajima to wear. Right. For full body shots, a second identical suit was created, which was much lighter than the first suit, but Nakajima was still only able to be inside for 3 minutes before passing out. Nakajima lost 20 pounds during the production of the film, and he would go on to portray Godzilla and other monsters until his retirement in 1972. Godzilla's name was also a source of consternation for the filmmakers. Because the monster had no name, the first draft of the film was not called Gojira, but rather titled G, also known as Development Plan G. The G of the title stood for giant, however. Nakajima confirmed that Toho held a contest to name the monster. The monster was eventually named Gojira, but it ended up being Gojira. His roar. So the recording artist initially used multiple roars from various large animals. These recordings ended up sounding like their animal counterparts and went unused. So the film's composer, Akira Ufukubi, decided to create the roar with instruments. He rubbed a leather glove through a loosened lower strings of a contrabass bass and altered the pitch and speed of the recording until the final roar was conceived. It happens. I mean, that's a natural path to take when it comes to making a roar. Following the film's success in Japan, Toho sold the American rights to Joseph E. Levin for $25,000. A heavily altered version of the film was released in the United States and worldwide as Godzilla, King of the Monsters on April 27, 1956. This version trimmed the original down to 80 minutes and featured new footage with Canadian actor Raymond Burr interacting with body doubles mixed with Honda's footage to make it seem like it was part of the original Japanese production. Many of the film's political themes were trimmed or removed completely. It was also this version of the original Godzilla film that introduced audiences worldwide to the character and the franchise, and the only version that critics and scholars had access to until 2004, when the 1954 film was released in select theaters in North America.
Oh, that's so painful to hear.
Right. Ooh. 2004. It was wasn't that long ago. At the time of the film's... Yeah. At the time of the film's release, Japanese reviews were mixed. Japanese critics accused the film of exploiting the widespread devastation that the country had suffered in World War II, as well as the incident that occurred a few months before filming began, the incident with the tuna fishing boat. Ishiro Honda lamented years later in the Tokyo Journal, quote, "They called it grotesque junk and said it looked like something you'd spit up. I felt sorry for my crew because they had worked so hard. At the time, they wrote things like, this movie is absurd because such giant monsters do not exist."
Wow. I wish I could get that high. Wow. It must have been high. Are they kidding? It's so good.
So let's talk a little bit about Godzilla. And since you have the t-shirt, Seth, we're going to start it with you.
Yeah, costume change. I definitely planned that. I planned that out.
So how many times have you seen this original Godzilla?
Oh, I have no idea. I have been a big Godzilla fan my whole life. Been pretty obsessed. I write reviews for anything Godzilla related for the Geekery site, actually. which is pretty fun that I've grown up to be a one website's Godzilla expert.
What sparked that? What's the Godzilla passion? Where does that come from?
It's just the best thing. It's great. I watched it as a kid. It was very formative. I was a big dinosaur kid, so Godzilla's a super dinosaur, so makes other dinosaurs look stupid by comparison. I grew up watching the one with Perry Mason or whatever, like, shoved into it that wasn't very great. And I, of course, at a young age, you're like you see a black and white movie and you think something's wrong, like it's broken. But now I watch it and it just looks so amazing. Like, Godzilla, I love all the Godzilla movies, but like, at the end of the day, I think Godzilla should be black and white. He just looks so good. Just like, kind of with like the drips from the seed glistening on him and stuff, and you can barely see him. He's like a big silhouette against the fire. He just looks so great.
Yeah. And we'll definitely kind of circle back to talking about like the franchise at large, because I do want to kind of talk about like how this one compares to, like, you know, even like the most recent iterations of Godzilla. But Jessica, had you ever seen this original Godzilla movie before?
So this is my first time actually watching it, which is pretty embarrassing because I've seen the other Godzilla movies and like also grew up with an older brother who was pretty obsessed with Godzilla, and specifically the movie with, was it Matthew Broderick?
Oh yeah.
Like that soundtrack was like a CD that was just in our car that we like listened to all the time, and it like there's songs that just had Godzilla's like roar in it, and I remember like listening to it.
It's like a Puff Daddy song where they sample Cashmere by Led Zeppelin. It's like really confusing.
It's a interesting CD. You should seek it out if you want to. But yeah, so this is my first time watching this one, which is also another reason why it's embarrassing, is because I had a pop-up at Central Cinema for my baking business at a showing of this movie, and I was just like so tired after the pop-up that I didn't stay for the movie, and now I'm sad that I didn't, because I got to watch it, and to see it on a big screen would have been very cool.
You're like, man, if I had one of those baked goods and I saw this movie, it would have been a great time. Oh well.
Yeah, so yeah, and I made Godzilla themed treats like for the movie, which was very cool. But yeah, like, it was my first time watching it, and it was a lot, and we can talk about this as we talk about like Godzilla as a character like changing over the years, but like, it was really sad. It was way sadder than I thought that it was going to be. And
it's a
obviously
bummer.
Yeah, it's a bummer of a movie, but for a good reason. I mean, you're talking about nuclear bomb just like destroying people's lives and them dealing with the fallout of something that no like humans have ever had to deal with. And so it makes sense like why it was impactful for them, but like the idea of Godzilla being created to make this fear relatable to everyone, like, because everyone can relate to being scared of this giant thing that is coming to destroy everything you know and love. And so, like, that, taking that metaphor of the nuclear bomb and turning it into this creature that is coming to destroy, you know, your homes and your families, and like translating that into something that everyone can understand no matter what culture you're from, and the performances by the people in the film and how they're screaming and like how devastated they are, and whenever they show like the young Japanese child that is just like crying and screaming because she saw, you know, her parent like die in front of her, like all of that is so real, and for, you know, a movie that is older, like for it to convey all of those things and all of that emotion, it's Like, it's crazy. I wish that every person who liked Godzilla would watch this movie, because you can see the purpose of the character, like, the purpose of his origins. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and also, I think that it's a testament to, like, the story that, like, you're talking about, because, you know, there is this degree of, like, kind of like silliness just in terms of like how it's constructed, because it's very clear that, like, you know, that you're dealing with kind of like a puppet at times, that you're dealing with like somebody in a suit at times, like, it, like, compared to a modern Godzilla or just a modern blockbuster, you know, I think a lot of modern audiences would watch it and be like, well, this looks incredibly fake. But to your point, like, I think it's still impactful that you watch this, because it is like just the story itself is very effective. Like, even though, you know, I think that there's something, I'm not saying that, like, as a detriment to the movie, that, you know, it, you can kind of see the wires for all intents and purposes, because I kind of like that. I think there's something about, like, the almost like the problem solving abilities of, like, the director and, like, the crew to, like, create that in a way. Like, there's, it's, like, incredibly impressive that they're able to just accomplish that in a movie made in 1954, where they're trying
to, first time it's ever been done.
Yeah, and they're this, like, trying to, like, kind of create this, like, massive scale, you know, around, I think I've seen, this is my second time watching it, and I think both times I've thought a lot about, like, just the more of, like, the effect of something like Jaws, like what Spielberg was doing with Jaws with the shark, where the entire time you know that the shark is fake. I mean, that's not the point of, like, believing that the shark is real. It's all about, like, you know, everything, like, he's going, I have to make all of the stuff around you feel very real and feel very visceral, so that, you know, you'll look past the fake shark. I mean, I feel like Godzilla is really the OG when it comes to that, because you can tell that that part of it is fake, but there's really something about, like Jessica's talking about, the performances and the story and what they're trying to get at, like, on a zeitgeist level, that I think is really impactful for a blockbuster movie. Because even though this wouldn't be categorized as a blockbuster movie, it, you know, it kind of feels very, like, akin to Jaws and Jurassic Park and things like that, where it's trying to appeal to a large audience but also speak to this really devastating story in Japanese history.
Yeah, and to speak to, like, the special effects in this, I still say that there is something that you just can't get with like with the way CGI works, especially with these more recent Godzilla films that are just like what you just said, which is that, okay, maybe the monster looks fake. We, like, obviously know monsters aren't real, so our minds are on like instantly going towards, like, explaining it, whether it's a puppet or CGI or whatever.
Or dismissing it, mm-hmm. You know, just kind of casting it off, yeah.
But what surrounds it, which in this case are, like, real models that we're not even sure how big everything is. We don't know, like maybe some of the footage is, like, real stuff blowing up. Like, it's real fire. Like, whereas, like, everything is CGI in, like, King Kong versus Godzilla, and you're just instantly, like, nothing is happening, like, in real time. Like, there's something so cathartic about seeing, like, somebody in a suit or, you know, just, like, pounding, like, some model into the ground.
Almost passing out, clearly.
Yes. That you're just, man, like, that's so crazy.
Crazy. I know.
And it's, you know, it's also a testament to this that it's able to grapple with a lot of these, like, heavy themes, because it's very clear what this is, like, engaging with. And I mean, it's kind of crazy that this comes out in 1954 and they're able to kind of, you know, it's not totally shocking, like, reading, like, how Japanese critics responded to it. Like, of course they're not going to be like, yeah, let's watch this movie that's reckoning with a very visceral history that's not even really history. It was, like, less than a decade ago.
Yeah. So soon.
You know, I can't imagine them doing that today, but I mean, like, you had, like, like years after 9/11, you had a lot of 9/11 movies like Oliver Stone's World Trade Center and things like that, where that came out like that were trying to like kind of capture the moment and like make, you know, understand the moment. But I think the difference between like those and that is, in this one, is that like, I think again, to the point about, you know, it being like this monster movie, it being like it, like there's like, there was something about like, United 93 and World Trade Center and movies like that that were like so serious, like we have to reckon with this moment and do it in the most serious way. And like the way that they handle World War II and nuclear bombs and, you know, just how like the United States in general, like in this movie, for being a monster movie, I feel like it handles that in such a way that like it's, I think we kind of are able to, like Jessica was talking about earlier, like digest it a little bit better, because it's not like the serious drama that's supposed to be taken, you know, with like, it's like some incredibly acclaimed thing. It's like, no, this is like, it's a monster movie at the end of the day. And, but it's still able to convey that in a way that's effective.
And the metaphor like goes on so many levels of like, it doesn't just stop. I realized this time it doesn't just stop at Godzilla, like all the other like atomic monsters, is just like a stand-in for the bomb or something like that. There's even this element, the old man, the paleontologist old man in this movie, who is like clearly has seen the devastation of the bomb and like, and has seen like how horrifying that is, and then
and
sees,
also gets it,
yeah.
Like, he gets it.
Oh, yeah. But then he sees, like, even beyond, like, the metaphor of Godzilla, he sees Godzilla as, like, something that survived the atomic bomb. And he's almost, like, there's, like, it starts out as, like, he's trying to, like, save Godzilla, like, in a save the whale kind of thing. But then you see it's even deeper that, like, if he could, like, harness whatever Godzilla is, like there could be surviving the bomb or something, like the way Godzilla survived the bomb. There's like hope there, and it's like kind of driving everybody crazy in that way. And it's really intense to watch.
And you also have another layer too of like not just Godzilla being like a metaphor for the bomb, but also this new invention that what's the eye patch guy's name?
I forgot, but yeah, we were talking about name. Seth and I were talking about him earlier.
Something like that. It starts with S. But because they just like are screaming his name on the boat at the end. So, but you also have his invention, which is the oxygen destroyer, and it is also like something that was created to destroy things, but on accident. And it's an invention that could potentially just like murder tons of fish, of people. I mean, and he knows that the other layer of the metaphor is that he knows that he could kill people with it, and he like can't control it, and that's why at the end he kills himself, because he's like, I have this knowledge in my head of this thing that could be so destructive for human beings that I can't live with myself knowing that I have it, and just like ends it all, which is just like another layer on top of it.
Well, he has that great line where he's there, it's when the couple confront him in his lab, and it's Sarizawa, and he's pretty much like when I start to use it, like it'll become like not appealing, but like I'll understand like why I created this and like get kind of almost enveloped in the whole process. And he's like, I don't want to get to that point, because if I do that, then I'm going to make more, I'm going to do more. And he's like, I don't need to be doing like, that's just, so that's kind of like, he kills himself, not just because he's like, oh, I have this knowledge, but it's also, I have this knowledge, and if I like go forward with it, I'll just become worse and worse and worse, and I'll become like those politicians that have, you know, that appear early, you know, early in the film, who are like going, we just have to like bomb this thing and just do whatever we need to do to kill it. And he's like, I don't want to become that, like I'd rather just kill myself than like kind of fall, like become more enveloped in that whole process.
And I can only imagine, like, from a Japanese perspective, like, that angle being, like, almost, like, so novel and, like, almost offensive. Because it's like, that through this character, like, we are...
You're sympathizing with the United States in this scenario.
Yeah. It's like this radical, like, empathy that this character, like, or we are made to have, like, or Japanese audiences are made to have with, like, the scientists who were a part of the, you know, the Manhattan Project, who, like, many of whom did not know what they were signing up for when they, like, added their stuff to the game and felt very guilty after what happened, which is really wild, rather than just going, like, full on, like blaming, like, God, like, blaming the United States and everything like that. It's really intense to really witness.
It's a very introspective movie. Like, to Jessica's point that it's a very sad movie, like, it's a very sad movie because it's very introspective and it's very insightful. Like, it's not, you know, I'm thinking of a recent movie that just came out. I talked about it last week, The Suicide Squad, which kind of tries to, like, add this layer of social commentary about the United States providing weapons and money to this, like, evil thing that's taking place in that movie. And, like, that's kind of the reveal where, you know, they're going after this evil, this alien that's been captured so they can harness the technology. And when they get there, they learn, oh, well, like, it's not just this, you know, random Latin American country that has been fueling this thing. It's the United States have been paying us the entire time. Like, that's who's funding this whole operation. And they're getting rid of it because they're trying to cut out their trail. And, like, but the, you know, that one, it kind of it tosses that in there in a way that, like, it's never really, like, investigating or engaging with that. It just kind of tosses that in there as, like, this kind of toss away social commentary that makes it less, you know, rather than just going, we have an evil, you know, an evil scientist and an evil thing over there. They try to kind of add this layer to it. And, like, that's what's so impressive about when I was watching Godzilla was, like, no, like, this movie is so engaging with so many different, it's not just engaging with, you know, the whole atom bomb. It's being very introspective. It's like, let's look at this from the perspective, like you said, Seth, of the U.S. scientists. Let's look at this of the perspective of the Japanese people, of the Japanese scientists, of the politician. You know, like, it's kind of looking at all these different facets, in a way that, again, it's like all under this guise of a monster movie. And to me, like, I love that kind of stuff. Like, that's so impressive to me.
Yeah. And on the other hand, if you are used to, like, modern day Godzilla movies, whenever you see Godzilla on the screen, you're like, woo, and you start, like, cheering instead of you being, like, afraid and scared of him. You're like, yeah, let's go, Godzilla's here. Which brings me to something that my boyfriend mentioned while we were watching this, which I thought was very funny, is that, like, you have this movie and it's like, okay, this is Godzilla, he's scary, we have to destroy him, and he is, like, killing everything we love. And then the second movie, which is like, eh, you know, like, Godzilla's here, but he can help us, like, beat this other thing that is, like, showing up. And then by the third movie, it's like, Godzilla's an Avenger, and he's going to, like, destroy
Godzilla.
Yeah.
Godzilla.
We're, like, calling Godzilla to help us defeat all these other things that we can't defeat. And
it's going to be super fun.
Yeah.
It's gonna be
and
super
he,
fun.
Like, turns into this, like, Godzilla's my bud, and he's the lesser of the other evils, so we're going to team up with him. And even to the point of having, like, snap zooms on his face and him being like, all right, let's get down to business. So it's very weird to think about to me, like, how he's turned into this iconic monster friend that the United States uses to help them beat other monsters.
Yeah, he sold out. Definitely.
I just imagine, like, Godzilla doing, like, the Chris Hemsworth, like, workout. He's just, like, you know, snapping Instagram photos. You're like, yeah, working out for the next one. Like,
yeah.
That's Godzilla
Pretty
now.
Much. Yeah.
That's what he's doing.
Over the hill.
Seth, for you, I'm sure that as a fan of Godzilla, you probably enjoy a lot of the ones along the way, from like this one to the Godzilla versus Kong movie that came out this year. But I mean, what do you make of like the progression of Godzilla as this character?
I think it is interesting. There's the really geeky, silly like 60s into the 70s stuff. But I think there is like there's a sweet spot in the 90s that we didn't get a lot of, called the Heisei period, which I would say like people who have sort of only seen the silly Godzilla movies, try and find around like the late 80s, there is like sort of a return to like the Japanese movies getting darker and more introspective. They don't reach this height, although they get close eventually with Shin Godzilla. If you can track it down, like it's the most, like I think it's one of the most unsung movies in a long time.
Big fans of Shin Godzilla here on the podcast. Yeah,
it is just really it's a Japanese revamp. Like the first real like you could call a remake of the 1954 version, and it gives it a whole new spin as far as like what it's more of like lampooning of bureaucracy and things like that. But I guess don't lose hope if you've only seen like the silly stuff. There is all the silly stuff is a great time.
Speaking of like lampooning bureaucracy, like one of my favorite scenes in this one is when they're having like the kind of courtroom scene where they have the scientists on one side who have presented like all of the science of Godzilla and like how we need to handle this. And then you have the politicians who are just like, let's blow stuff up. And I love in that scene because like you initially could just have those two, like you could have the scientist side and the politician side. You could make like your whole like connections to like modern day politics all you want. But like, I love in that scene that you have those two sides, but then you have that one woman who's just screaming at him, and like it's great because like the scientists present their stuff, the politicians mm-hmm. like, no, let's just blow stuff up, and then the woman just going, what are you talking about, are you stupid?
That's great.
And it's just her, I just like, she's just yelling at him, I love it. And then to the point where they're like, can we please get her out because she's just berating us. So yeah, I enjoyed that scene a lot because you could pull like your current event type connections to it, but I'm like, no, but we don't have that one woman who's just like screaming like, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, you idiot.
We need that.
We need that lady. Where is she?
Yeah, we need her. She's really the real hero of that. It's interesting, you know, going back to kind of like looking at the different Godzillas, like you said, Jessica, like the current iteration of Godzilla now, like in the Gareth Edwards movie, I don't know, Seth, how you feel about the modern Godzilla, but he really is like kind of become almost this like Avengers type figure where, you know, like I think in the Godzilla, the first one of like the recent revamp, you know, they kind of really wanted to play with like the scope and like in kind of that almost like a sandbox type situation of like playing with like Godzilla's in the city. Let's play around with like just the scope of that. But it's also a movie that completely just misses that. You know, what's effective about this movie is all of these, you know, all of this kind of narrative stuff that we're describing. And it's all about, you know, people jumping out of planes and things like that.
Yeah, it's an action movie. It's a shame. And a lot of it is just so... I mean, I thought I had a good time with Godzilla vs. Kong, but it was just so cartoonish and, like... Which, it was fine, but it's a shame they can't do more with the character as far as, like... Because there's real... And they did it in 1954, and, like, there's real dread... He has these horrifying, weird eyes, and he is just like, he feels huge, and it's like even like now watching it, you can like in one frame laugh at like the puppet or something, but the next frame they are like reinforcing it with a woman holding her child saying, "We're about to join daddy." Like, that's a direct quote. And it's just like going to that level of just like intensity is, I feel like, what you gotta do, like, to really sell this like crazy monster.
Well, the scene when you kind of meet him for the first time and he like pokes his head out from behind that hill, yeah, is kind of, you're that? Just like, oh my god, like, yeah. Hi. Like, he is, like, it's a little shocking because, like, it almost feels more modern because it feels like he's actually there, but he just kind of pokes his head out and you're just like, oh, you know. But yeah, like the scene where he's just kind of stomping through the town and you don't really get a full shot of him. You're just kind of getting like shots of like the houses kind of falling down and like his feet.
Again, like, the that's Jaws thing, like you said.
Yeah, it's very much like it feels like a prototype to like Jaws, where, you know, like the first kill in Jaws, where when he kills the kid, like, and all you see is the blood and the water, like all you see is the houses falling down, and you see the people screaming, and you see like the rain, and it is very frightening. I think that they handle it really well.
Oh yeah, and then there's like montages of like I still just can't get over like. That Hiroshima was like so recent in like before this movie that there are montages that just look like footage from like the aftermath. There's like just like long-winded montages of like TV footage that we're watching, and it's like with like children's choirs like singing this like full song like mourning the dead. Like, there's just no like, oh my gosh, like, again, really wrecking the party with this one. It's really intense.
Yeah, there are so many things in this movie too that are just so, they feel very technically advanced for a 1954 movie. Like, whenever they shoot the scene underwater, whenever they're in the suits, and that's a whole thing underwater. Like, it looks so good, and I was like, there's no way. Like, when we get to the water part, I was like, there's no way we're going to be able to see what they're doing underwater. And then the camera goes underwater, and you're like, okay, well, let's do this. And the Godzilla puppet is also underwater in that part, too, which is crazy, crazy. I don't know how they did that. Like, had a big tank of water that they put the puppet guy in. Like, I don't know. I have no idea.
That's why I said like earlier, like there's, you can see the strings, but there's something so creative about this movie that I just like. It reminds me. That's why I say like it reminds me of Jaws. Like, it's another movie that you can see the strings, but there's something so creative and so like you can tell that they were like, well, how can we show this in the most effective way as we can? Like, you know, like
they did it. It looks magical. I think it is. I really compare this one to Star Wars in the way that there's no planning this in a way. They definitely like did the good work, like, and it just as like George Lucas, like, you know, like brought his A game and what he could. But like I can imagine it's first and foremost a movie that like comes together like with all the elements in the end, with like the soundtrack is a big part of this. Like, I'm sure like you could laugh while you're on set, again, similar to Star Wars, that like this is like, what is this? Like, what is this? And then once you actually like see it, there's something like just a magical combination that happened here, I think.
Yeah, it's you know, it feels like a movie. Like, it feels like something that like, you know, you could only experience in this way. And like, I agree, like, it feels very, it's like they're reacting to stuff. Like, I'm sure they've storyboarded and they've like worked it out, but it's a lot of like, we have to like react to whatever we have the means to do. We don't like, you know, like, so there was that, not to go on a long tangent, but there was that whole thing about how they had the green screen behind, they were at like a bar in Black Widow, and they like, instead of like going to a bar and shooting the scene, they had like a green screen behind it and just like, you know, just shot it in a studio.
That's some George Lucas.
And people were like kind of going on about, and like, you know, I don't know. To me, I kind of get that. Like, you kind of need like, the uncertainty of like that's what's great about movies is that it's like you kind of toss the elements in there and you're like, we're just gonna see if we like, it's not gonna be 100% perfect, it's not gonna be exactly as you envision, there's gonna be like this imperfection to it. And I feel like this movie's a lot of that. It's a lot of imperfection, and it's a lot of like, this is like what we can accomplish. It may not look 100%, but this is what we can accomplish, and it will be effective for the narrative. Like, it's gonna fit the narrative. And I think that feels very pure and genuine to me.
Yeah, and there are also just like some cinematic techniques in here in the way that the story is told that is crazy. Like, whenever you first see, I don't remember what the girl's name is, it Amiko?
Yeah, I think Amiko.
Whenever she goes to the eye patch guy's lab, and
he is
showing her the experiment, and we don't see, like, he drops something in the tank. We don't see what happens to the fish inside, and it's just like zoom in on her face. She's horrified, and then we leave, and I was sitting there screaming, what happened? And my boyfriend was like, just watch the movie. And I was like, I want to know what happened to those fish inside. And then, you know, da 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 da, we go towards the end of the movie, and then she's like, okay, I have something to tell you, to the other guy, and then zoom in on her face, and then fade out into a flashback of what happens in the fish tank. And he like puts the oxygen destroyer in the tank, and boom, fish bones just show up, and you're like, this is movie magic, baby. Like, this is,
yeah, you're so, yeah, excited, because you're like, yes, I'm finding out now.
Yeah, it's so good.
That would be a risky, I feel like that would be viewed as a risky narrative move, like, now in a script. Like, people would be like, I don't know, we might lose, like, they'll be like wondering what happened for all of 20 minutes, you know.
We'd have to like stop it there, and then have a whole origin series on Disney Plus to explain like what actually like led to that moment, like 10 episodes we involve Owen Wilson. Yeah. And then we could explain that scene.
No, it's so cool, it's such a good move. That like no one really, like, it's like above and beyond, kind of like no one was asking, everybody was just asking for the monster, you know. But it's cool that that's just one example. I also really love, you can tell they really got like one of what I assume is a like a, an influence on this is War of the Worlds or something. Like I just imagine like that was an influence because of how it's set up. It's not, which a lot of the movies that this inspired did not follow the same setup, which is a complicated like ensemble. It's like about an event happening. There are like those central like four or five characters, but we go long stretches without seeing them, and it is about like accurately, like sometimes like in kind of like a slow burn kind of way, just like showing like people on phones and people like this is how it would happen, like if there was a monster, like
there's technically like a romance involved in it, like you're not super, I was just kind of like whatever.
Which, that was hilarious because like the one guy is like, they're showing all this like how they're evacuating Tokyo and stuff, and then they cut to him like looking out at the city, and then he turns to Amiko and he's like, I think I'm going to ask your dad for consent to marry you.
And you're like, and I was sitting in here going, you know, like, stuff's going on right now. Like, read the room.
Can we talk about this later?
Yeah, like, and then he has the gall to tell, like, the dad, oh, we need to kill Godzilla. And the dad's like, I've been talking about how I don't want to kill Godzilla
the whole time.
I was sitting in my room with the lights off because I didn't want to kill Godzilla.
I was sitting in my room with the lights off because I love Godzilla so much that I couldn't
and
even imagine.
You just
imagine.
Come in here?
And you walk
and
into
now
my
you
home.
Wanna marry my...
You walk into my home and you talk about wanting to kill Godzilla. Get out of my house.
Exactly. I bet you want to marry my daughter, too.
So good.
Asshole.
And the guy's just like, I feel like somewhere our wires got crossed.
He's like,
yeah, he sucks.
Wasn't tactful. And it's like, you think that wasn't?
Even at the end, he's trying to, like, tag himself on, like, the... the guy with the eye patch is going down, he's like gonna sacrifice himself with the oxygen destroyer, and then like the handsome guy has to like, no, I'm an experienced diver, I have to go down there with you just to go down there and then come back and let you die and do the rest.
Well, he is very handsome, that's for sure.
He is handsome.
He is. I would say they both are, but
I don't know.
He's an idiot.
I don't know. Eye patch is fine.
He's got like a he's got like a Japanese James Dean thing happening.
He's fine.
Well, if you have not seen the 1954 Godzilla yet, it's on Criterion Channel, but it's also available on HBO Max. And so I would recommend going and watching this and skipping the stupid, bastardized American version. just watch the OG one.
Yep, that's right.
It's metal.
The OG.
Metal.
I think everybody here would recommend it. All right, well, that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we post all the movies we talked about in this episode. Head over to patreon.com/cinematary. Thank you so much to our patrons, Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Corey Willingham, Harry Eskin, Candace Sisson, Ron Hayes, Tyler Chandler, and Whitney Rio Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Next week, we'll be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1967's Point Blank. So we kind of dive into the 60s. Exciting time. Till then, thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week.